Hello, I'm Marlene Saeed. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your look at the world of business and economics. This week, as the Arctic warms at twice the pace of the rest of the planet, who will protect it from oil and gas exploration? The big money enabling big oil to drill for crude despite pledges to go green. As we burn more fossil fuels, the ice is melting in Greenland, uncovering much-needed rare earth minerals that will power a greener economy. But Greenland's sheep farmers are protesting against the plans to mine. And as India deepens its reliance on coal, we're at the site of an underground fire that's been burning for more than 100 years, destroying thousands of homes and making the area uninhabitable for many of the town's residents. For almost half a century, the International Energy Agency had one goal: make sure its patrons, the world's richest nations, had uninterrupted access to oil. Now the Paris-based organization is warning the world to stop developing new oil and gas fields to avoid a catastrophic rise in temperatures. But is anyone paying attention? Big finance and big oil are continuing to plow billions of dollars into new production. And ironically, they're targeting the Arctic, a region where the delicate environment has seen extraordinary melting of ice due to the burning of fossil fuels. Now, according to Reclaim Finance, the banking industry has provided $314 billion for oil companies between the years 2016 and 2020. And investors held roughly $272 billion in oil and gas stocks and bonds, sailing a supertanker through their own climate change commitments. There are 599 oil and gas fields in the Arctic, 222 are currently in production, 39 are under development, and 238 have been discovered. In the next 5 years, Arctic oil and gas production is expected to increase by 20%. Take a look at this map of 20-plus oil companies that are developing new oil and gas fields in the Arctic. The biggest expansion is happening in areas under Russian control. 74% of Gazprom's oil and gas reserves are based there. America's ConocoPhillips is expected to increase production levels by 36% by 2030. And despite Europe having some of the most aggressive net zero emission targets, nearly half of the oil companies are European. By 2030, France's Total Energies will increase production by 28%. But it's not just oil and gas that's being uncovered as ice sheets melt. In Greenland, huge deposits of rare earth elements have been exposed. These are vital in the production of low-carbon technologies such as electric cars and wind turbines. But farmers worried about radioactive dust and wastewater are trying to block these mining projects. Al Jazeera's environment editor Nick Clark visited the town of Narsaq in South Greenland, the site of one proposed mine.
A statue of Leif Erikson, the Viking who's said to have discovered America 400 years before Columbus, gazes out over a scene that might surprise you. It's the end of summer and the sheep have been rounded up for market. Farming is part of the way of life in the south, but these lands also hold new possibilities. I headed up a mountain valley near the town of Narsaq. The rocks here hold some of the world's richest deposits of rare earth minerals. This is the site of an old uranium mine. It's long been decommissioned, but now international mining companies want to dig deep again.
The rock we see all around us here was formed 3 or 4 kilometres beneath the Earth's crust, and then about a billion years ago, these mountains just reared up. And they reckon that within this area alone, there are 1.5 million tonnes of rare earth minerals, with another 26 million tonnes at a site nearby. And all of that combined is enough to supply the world's total need of rare earth minerals for 115 years, which is why this whole area is just so valuable and has so much attention.
This is my mother's father.
I met with Neil Sikariasen, who's been fighting the proposed mine for years.
Man, I just have a lot to say.
If the mine gets the go-ahead, the first thing that will affect us is dust, followed by radioactive radiation. Those things will start from the first day of production. That's going to affect our water supply, and it's only 3 kilometres away from the mining site, meaning we won't be able to continue living in Narsaq.
Public meetings were held earlier in the year with the mining company involved, although they didn't attend the most recent ones. They're Greenland Minerals, who are Australian and part Chinese-owned. Their CEO told Al Jazeera,
"There's been misinformation about the project in the community that does not accurately reflect the impact assessments and has caused concern among local stakeholders. This is unfortunate when the project has met stringent environmental standards. Mining would bring jobs, business opportunities and economic stimulus for the local community."
Across Greenland, the issue is so controversial it toppled the national government, and in came the Indigenous Inuit Party, who have promised to stop the mine. But they recognise a future government might reverse that. As the day draws to a close, more sheep are being rounded up. The farmers have grave concerns about the impact of toxic waste on the land and waterways the sheep thrive on.
The water will be poisoned and the sea will be poisoned, and then we will be poisoned. I will never accept the mining. The Greenlandic culture have been keep going in 1,000 years. Not many people could survive here and just be strong to live here in Greenland.
Long ago, the Vikings saw the potential of this part of Greenland. And as the ice sheet melts, making more mining sites accessible, interest in Greenland's rich resources will only increase.
Right, let's get some analysis. I'm joined by Alex Mazzulli, a fossil-free finance campaigner at Reclam Finance. Alex is the principal author of their latest report on oil drilling in the Arctic. Alex joins me from Paris. Many thanks for speaking to us on the programme. Now, the UN's climate body, the IPCC, and the International Energy Agency, they've both warned that it's critical that we don't develop any new oil and gas fields. But that's not what's actually happening in the Arctic, is it?
Yes, it's in fact a very, very big problem and an increasing threat, because the Arctic is already under threat from climate change, but it's increasingly under threat from the oil and gas industry. Our research shows that there are more and more companies developing more and more extraction projects, enough to ramp up production in the Arctic by 20% in the next 5 years. And things could get even worse, because in total we counted that there are an extra 200 or so oil and gas fields that are yet to be extracted. And in total, this would be enough to burn 22% of our global carbon budget by 2050 if we want to stay below 1.5 degree, which is the global aim, of course. And given the climate and environmental emergency that we're facing, the Arctic should definitely be off limits for the oil and gas industry immediately.
What's interesting is that many banks and financial institutions have made Arctic pledges, haven't they? But despite that, their money is still getting to those oil companies that are drilling in the Arctic. Why is that happening?
Well, that's definitely what I would call the Arctic paradox, and a very good example of the gaps that we can see between grand pledges that are made typically at COP26 and reality on the ground. Because big banks are, across the world, are pledging to become carbon neutral. They are pledging to stop supporting oil and gas extraction in the Arctic. Unfortunately, the numbers tell another story. Support for Arctic oil and gas extraction has continued completely unabated in past years, despite all these policies being implemented. They are failing to stop oil and gas extraction in the Arctic, particularly because of the major loopholes in those policies. For example, they can still keep funding the companies that develop the projects. They decide they have a pick-and-choose approach on their geographic scope of the Arctic, and some of them will keep supporting gas projects, despite the fact that they're, you know, also climate bombs in the making.
Explain to me the geographic definition a little more clearly, because it's all about the definition of the Arctic and how they're using that to their advantage.
So the big problem we have is that there is no set definition of the Arctic, right? There are no clear boundaries to the Arctic, and this has been used by financial players to their advantage to sort of pick and choose what scope of the Arctic they choose to protect, so-called protection. And we counted more than 13 definitions of the Arctic used by different banks, investors and insurers in their Arctic policies, which goes to show how many different ways there are to qualify the Arctic. Unfortunately, of course, all those definitions tend to restrict the scope of the Arctic instead of broaden the exclusion and protection zone. And good news, though, last week, for the first time, a major French insurer, AXA, agreed to broaden the scope of its Arctic policy and use the one that is recommended today by civil society, so the broader one that encompasses all of the Arctic ecosystems.
Well, that leads us very nicely to do some naming and shaming. Which financial institutions, investors in the Arctic are heavily invested there, and what is their exposure? Can you talk through some of the big players?
Yes. So we differentiate banks and investors. Bankwise, in total, we counted $314 billion in financial support from around 100 banks to Arctic companies developing new projects currently. Among them, the top bankers are JP Morgan Chase, with a more than $18 billion spent on these companies in the past 4 years. And JP Morgan Chase typically, for example, has been supporting Gazprom, which is a major player in the Arctic as a producer and as a developer. There is nowhere JP Morgan does not know that. So when they support Gazprom with, you know, a loan, for example, they are supporting their overall plans in the Arctic, despite the fact that JP Morgan Chase now has an Arctic policy. And one among the other big bankers, we have Barclays with $13 billion, Citigroup with around $12 billion, and BNP Paribas, the French bank, with around $11 billion. And then investor-wise, the ones leading the pack are BlackRock. As per usual, BlackRock is always heavily vested in the oil and gas industry. We also have Vanguard and the French Amundi, which is also a big player in the Arctic. Of course, there are many more. In total, we counted around $270 billion invested in those 20 companies that are currently developing new oil and gas projects in the Arctic.
So why is it that they're allowed to continue doing this? Have they been challenged about their investments? And what is their response?
That's a good question, actually. I mean, the response has yet to come. Officially, they're not actually contradicting their policies. They're not, we can't say that they're doing something wrong based on what their policy says. The problem is the policy is ineffective and designed to be ineffective. That's what I was saying about Gazprom and JP Morgan. Of course they know, but that by saying that they will stop supporting projects in the Arctic, they are not stopping any support to the companies in the Arctic. So we see major loopholes in all the policies, be it in terms of corporate financing, be it in terms of the geographic scope picked by the bank or the insurer. And the fact is, at the end of the day, support has continued unabated. In certain cases, it has even increased. For example, HSBC, BNP Paribas were both top supporters in 2020 of Arctic companies, despite having made their Arctic pledges in 2017 and 2018. So there's been time, and yet support is increasing. So this is definitely a policy issue, but it needs to change. And we are hearing that some of the banks and insurers are looking to change their policy, but we have yet to see more improvement.
This week, of course, was COP26, the Global Climate Conference in Glasgow. And we have had pledges made from some of the banks you've mentioned, in fact, many of the top financial institutions, that they will commit $130 trillion of their capital, their own capital, to help economies transfer to net zero carbon emissions by 2050. What do you make of this pledge and other pledges like this?
It goes back to the same climate paradox of these pledges. I mean, from what we understand so far, these pledges don't actually mention the big elephant in the room, which is, when do we start phasing down and phasing out fossil fuel production? So progress has been made on coal, for example, but there has been no progress made around oil and gas, around the oil and gas production problem. And the fact that, yes, as we can see, it's not just in the Arctic, it's across the world. There are new projects being developed every day, every year, every month. And this is unacceptable. As you said earlier, the IEA, the International Energy Agency, has been very clear that if we want to stay below 1.5 degree, we need to stop expanding oil and gas production. And this is definitely not the direction we're going into. And the fact that the banks, yesterday or the day before have been making commitments around climate and carbon neutrality, but never, never say we will no longer support oil and gas expansion, for example, just goes to show that we still have a long way ahead before banks actually commit to a greener future.
Alex Mazzuni, really good to talk to you. Fossil free finance campaigner at Reclaim Finance. Thank you.
Thank you.
Burning coal is the biggest source of electricity globally and the biggest source of carbon dioxide emissions. The world's 20 largest economies have agreed to end financing of coal power plants overseas. But there was no commitment to curbing usage at home. And there was no end date for the use of coal. Without firm pledges, the world is currently on track to miss its goal of limiting the rise of global average temperatures to 1.5 degrees Celsius. As India deepens its reliance on coal, Al Jazeera's Elizabeth Piranham travels to the Jharia coal mine in Jharkhand, when underground fire has been burning for more than 100 years, destroying thousands of homes and making the area uninhabitable for many of the town's residents.
These fires have been burning across the Jharia coalfield in India's eastern state of Jharkhand for more than 100 years. They've destroyed thousands of homes and made much of Jharia town uninhabitable. Dilip Bauri is now a single parent after his 30-year-old wife, Kalyani Devi, fell into a pit while taking their daughter to use the toilet. The ground here often caves in because of the fires.
My daughter came running and said, "Mummy has fallen into a pit." I rushed to the spot and I pray to God that no one has to ever see a sight like that.
Jharia is India's most lucrative coal field, but also the site of one of its biggest environmental disasters. Underground fires were first detected in 1916 in abandoned mines which weren't decommissioned properly. More recently, two decades of unrestrained open-cast mining has brought the fires to the surface, but the Indian government is pushing ahead with plans to expand the sector in Jharkhand and beyond.
India is developing. It's industrializing, and for that we need power, and more power is needed for the, and 70% we depend upon this thermal power.
India is already the world's second largest producer, consumer and importer of coal. Jharkhand is home to the country's largest coal reserves, but also to forests rich in biodiversity.
The coal block under these fields and that forest was auctioned to one of India's biggest companies nearly a year ago, but no work has started. That's because the state of Jharkhand is challenging the central government's plans in the Supreme Court on environmental grounds. There are plans to convert these fields and large tracts of forest into mines, displacing tens of thousands of people who often belong to indigenous tribes.
Politicians in Jharkhand say any expansion must take people into consideration.
Now the problem here is everyone wants coal, government wants coal, we want expansion. But what is the cost? People are paying for it. The truth is that there is an expansion, but people are not getting their due. You want to have a coal block, you want to have the coal. But what about the people living above the surface?
Like thousands of others, Dilip Bauri says he won't leave Jharia because the government hasn't provided proper accommodation elsewhere. As India's electricity demand grows with its economy, environmentalists say it must prioritise clean energy for any development to be beneficial in the years to come.
Coal capacity has doubled in Southeast Asia since 2010. Institutional investors have poured $1 trillion into companies operating in the global coal industry. Now, the Asian Development Bank plans to buy coal plants in Asia and shut them down over the next 10 to 15 years. Is that part of the answer to our climate change challenge? Well, I'm joined by Katharina Hillenbrand von der Neyen, the head of research at Carbon Tracker. Many thanks for joining us on the programme. What do you make of the ADB's plans to buy and shut down coal plants in South Asia?
It's an interesting proposition, but clearly this illustrates what we have been saying for quite some time. It highlights stranding risk. So stranded assets are those that will not run to their full end of their lifetime. And investors will not recoup the full amount of their investment. And clearly, if they are now being bought and being shut down ahead of their lifetime, that is, could precisely be a crystallization of what we have coined as the stranded asset risks.
And by buying these coal plants, are we not rewarding financial institutions for the bad decisions they've made in the past?
Clearly, at Carbon Tracker, we don't think somebody else buying these plants will resolve the climate problem. The reality is you really have to shut them down, because otherwise all you have is another owner keeping, potentially operating them. But in this case, the positive news is that they're getting shut down. So what we are looking at is some form of an orderly wind down. We find it most important that the wind down happens in an orderly fashion so that you do not get massive disruption risk. So in a sense, this purchase agreement is, or this deal is probably a slightly more orderly wind down than an outright shut, because you do get some compensation. But clearly, somebody will have to pay for that loss, for that stranding risk.
Indeed, that is the problem. How do you convince... sorry for interrupting you, but how do you convince governments to back these kinds of plans when there are livelihoods and jobs at risk?
Well, clearly, those are big issues with regards to jobs and social communities. But you also have to keep in mind that by now, in most cases, outright renewables are already cheaper than coal. And you actually get a benefit to consumers and you get a benefit to the system. So ultimately, the energy transition will be cheaper if you execute it now and put into place orderly transition plans and phase out schedules. Because otherwise, you will get a disorderly wind down, you will get much more volatility, and the cost will ultimately be much, much higher in financial terms as well as climate terms.
Are there any countries where policies have been implemented successfully, which can be translated to other countries?
You had the EU is obviously quite ahead, and you could also say the UK. Europe is much ahead in its coal phase-out policies, and there is hardly any coal on the system at all. It has done so by incentivizing renewables and by putting a carbon price in. And that has really led now to the market pushing coal out of the system. And really, a carbon price has been one of the most successful tools to get that transition underway.
The difficulty, of course, is those are the richer developed countries you're talking about. In developing countries, it's much more of a challenge. We heard from India's Prime Minister recently, who said that developed nations should contribute a large chunk of their finance for this energy transition of poorer developing nations. What is the solution, do you think, to make these changes in developing countries?
There is a great chance in many developing countries to actually achieve access to energy through renewables. We are still going through a phenomenon of incredibly strong energy and electricity demand growth. So actually filling that with renewables is a great opportunity. And a lot of these countries are actually home to a great resource base. So they have a natural advantage of putting that transition into place. So it is two-pronged, really. It is about putting the right regulatory system in place and letting the market propulse forward that energy transition, because you have the natural resource base. In many countries, you even have the manufacturing base that is required, whereas you may be importing coal, you may be running ineffective plant that's expensive to run, that you're then having to subsidize through market-distorting regulatory system. And it is our view that the most successful thing, most likely to be successful thing that these countries can do is get away from distortionary regulatory practices and actually now allow the market to do its job and put into place the energy transition, because ultimately it will be just and it will be cheaper for the entire spectrum of society.
Many thanks for your thoughts, Katharina Hillenbrand von der Neyen, the head of research at Carbon Tracker.
Thank you very much. Bye.
And that is our show for this week. Get in touch with us by tweeting me at Marlene Saeed. And do use the hashtag AJCCC when you do. Or drop us an email, countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our address. And there's more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That will take you straight to our page, which has entire episodes for you to catch up on. That is it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Marlene Saeed from the whole team. Thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.